This is the podcast for November 18th, 2011. It's not safe for work.
Recorded live from just outside the throne room of Potty Shaw Emperor Michael Bloomberg, it's the Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Hey!
Hey!
Greetings, gals and guys. We're recording this as late as we possibly can.
Yeah, this is live. We're doing it live, Blue Gal.
Honestly, we are. It's almost noon on Friday, which is the absolute latest we've ever recorded the podcast. And we've had technical difficulties and traveling difficulties, and it's getting to be the holidays. So we're winging it, and we're glad to be winging it. Thank you so much for your kind words and contributions this week. And Occupy Wall Street is...
What Blue Gal's trying to say is I was drunk for the last 2 days, and we couldn't record anything. All right, Occupy Wall Street. I wasn't drunk for the last 2 days.
No, but... he was painting his condo.
Yes, I was. All right. Onward, Occupy Wall Street.
And if anyone wants a gorgeous condo in Jan Schakowsky's district, by the way,
steps
it's going
to
be on the market.
Park.
Yeah.
Public transportation, it's a gorgeous place. It really is. And for liberals, special deal.
Special deal for liberals, and it's very close walking distance to...
everything.
To Heartland Cafe, I was thinking. Yeah. Hippie heaven.
So occupy my condo.
Please. Occupy my condo, please.
Yeah. Remember, property is not theft when you buy it from me.
And property is not theft, apparently, when the police kick you out of the park.
Yeah. Speaking of which, good segue, Blue Gal.
Seriously, William Kunstler would be so happy about this turn of events because we've got our Bull Connor with Mayor Bloomberg. It's like, thank you. Before the hippie camp could become a parody of itself, it becomes a cause célèbre.
Yeah.
And what more could you ask for as a movement than that, you know, to be the downtrodden and have this beef now with the cops, which is...
to be rousted by the cops at the behest of the billionaire mayor.
Yeah, it just...
of the capital.
Thank you.
Yeah. The king of all Wall Street. And the head of his own media empire, you know, our own Berlusconi.
Really, it just is that bad. And and now, you know, there's now so much more energy in the movement, and there's so much more drive. Thousands of people marching yesterday, Thursday, and the creativity
also,
of it all.
If you could possibly find your way. Mayor Bloomberg to arrange to have little old ladies and priests maced or pepper sprayed.
And Bibles thrown away by the cops.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And if that little old lady could possibly stagger into the arms of an Iraq war vet.
Yeah. That was in Seattle. That wasn't in New York City. But
But it's the movement.
Yeah.
That is what the face of the movement is now. On the one side, it's Michael Bloomberg and thug police. I'm sorry, but you know, 90% of the cops are great. But these guys were just pulled from central casting for overreaction. Yeah. And then you have the Mario Savio Square being overrun by, you know, truncheon-wielding cops trying to drive out free speech activists. And, of course, hovering over it all, you have Michael Bloomberg.
And no one ever has taken any notice that Abbie Hoffman ever existed. You know, that political theater isn't effective because it is. It really, really is. One of the things that I love about this movement, too, is how artistic it is.
Yeah.
And yesterday, I don't know if you noticed the bat signal that was beamed onto the wall, the outside wall of the Verizon building in New York City.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Giant blue circle with 99% in the middle of it beamed by light. As they were marching across the bridge, all of a sudden there's this 99%, gigantic 99% just beamed onto the building. And fantastic. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just saying necessity and being downtrodden is the mother of invention.
And the mother of movements and gets more people involved and gets the silent majority on your side. Let me tell you about UCal Berkeley. Because, you know, Berkeley protesters don't have any history about...
No.
No. Sorry, I just find this so hilarious. The university told them they couldn't pitch tents for Occupy UCal Berkeley. So they put them on helium balloons and floated them over the university building. I swear to God. And now there are like 4 or 5 tents floating. They're not pitched, mister.
No.
You know, Mr. President of the university. No tents pitched here.
Those who forget history are condemned to repeat the 60s.
Yeah. Well, and now the 30s, too. I think Angry Black Lady is absolutely right. It's time to train ourselves for political success in demanding revolution of the banks, of the financial industry, and of Congress. And, you know, they'll have to compromise with us, which means there will be reforms. But well, take a page out of the Republican Party. Demand everything.
Demand everything.
And don't waver.
You pointed this out. We had to throw away an entire podcast because of the technical difficulties that we pointed out. But you pointed out, let's just call it our gigantic pregame, that basically the entire middle class, the entire property-owning middle class social security safety net was a compromise.
Yes, right.
That we achieved during the 40s and 50s that saved capitalism.
That was the whole point was, you know, there were people in this country that wanted an overthrow.
Yeah.
And let's try to save democracy and make it not be a communist state by giving in a little bit to the social safety net.
Yeah.
And that's what homeownership was. We talked about that last week. You know, the idea that you would have a middle class owning a piece of the American dream meant they wouldn't go on strike.
Yeah.
And so it will buy them off. Well, it's time for them to buy us off again. And if they
forgot that.
They're in trouble. Yeah, they can't take it all.
They have forgotten that. And one of the things I'm trying to prevent myself from doing I'm trying to keep myself from fighting the last war.
Yeah.
I'm trying to keep myself from being, because I wasn't old enough to participate in the student movement or the civil rights movement. Or the anti-war movement that was slightly before my time. I was 7 years old watching Batman in the Philippines as the Tet Offensive took place. So I was not exactly in the thick of it. But what I learned, everything I know about protest movements, I learned from history. And what I'm trying to, in my own mind, sort out the difference between tactics and strategy. Because the strategy is always going to be, you know, heighten the absurdity of power, heighten the absurd relationship between the media and the politics and Wall Street in this country that is perpetually, constantly bought out, sold out, completely circled, completely encircling us in a way that's oppressive, but often padded with soft words and soft phrases. And the way you break through that is by taking them at their word. Keep forcing them to live up to the American dream, to the American promise. Right. Keep asking really hard questions. And eventually they start to freak out because they don't have any intention of having a democracy at the end of the 21st century.
Right.
And the American
dream isn't for you. It's not for everybody. We don't want everybody to have that. Just our tribe, you know. When you rip that mask off, it's like, whoa.
And that's the thing, that the tactics must change because media has changed. There's no longer three networks. You can no longer have Walter Cronkite. You can no longer have Dan Rather being beaten up on the floor of the Democratic National Convention. You can't have reporters being bloodied in Grant Park and then being on the network the next day essentially in bandages.
Yep.
Those days are over. So the methods that protesters used to capture attention, because remember, protests are always poor people, downtrodden people, the underprivileged versus power.
Right.
Because power has no reason to protest.
There's no march for millionaires, really, because they've got it. What do they need? Right.
And the last couple of summers full of marches accomplished nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Glenn Beck freaking out on the Mall in D.C. was a spectacle that went nowhere. John Stewart's desperate attempt to try to pretend that both sides do it was a comedic success, I suppose, but a failure. But the traditional approach of putting hundreds of thousands or millions of people into the streets, as we learned in Iraq, the cameras just turned away.
Well, and the cameras are becoming less and less relevant.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, when you have 7,000 tweets an hour about OWS, or 10,000 or 15,000 tweets an hour about that. And everyone is watching their Twitter streams on their iPhones or wherever they are to find and seeing photos and videos and images right in real time. Mm-hmm. The streaming had, I think I was looking at the streaming, it kept crashing my machine, but you know, the streaming of the live march and the cops and the fact that those cameras were on affected everybody's behavior.
And and that drives the news cycle.
Exactly.
You're not waiting for
the six o'clock news anymore. And I wanted to say, you mentioned Glenn Beck. I think Glenn Beck actually helped in large part to destroy the Tea Party movement with that rally, because that was such a bait and switch of, we came here to hear the Kenyan usurper, which, you know, is code for the N-word, trashed. And what we got was a Mormon plea for tithing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in the Tea Party didn't want to hear that. You know, that wasn't their thing.
That Glenn Beck had scribbled on the back of some envelope the night before.
Yeah, exactly.
This rambling, ranting, and which is all really he ever was and all he ever will be. But again, the tactic of capturing the news has changed as the technology of news delivery had changed. But the strategy of wrapping your movement in people who look like they come from your neighborhood.
Yep. And our priests and nuns in habits and
exactly
and
nice little
ladies,
kids, grandmothers,
and bring your children and
people in suits. Yeah. I mean, you know, I on a typical work day in my life, I look like a goddamn narc.
Yeah.
I'm a dirty liberal. I'm a dirty hippie. But I, you know, that's the difference. The difference is when you look at Glenn Beck's mobs or you see a bunch of dyspeptic old white people in their hover rounds that Medicare paid for, bitching about government spending on brown people and liberals. That's what you see. That's pretty much all you see. And occasionally you'll see the rare Herman Cain scattered in the crowd. This is which is why they have these special days at the Republican convention, when all the outliers, all the people who aren't angry white men from the South are given a couple of hours on stage to show what a tolerant group of people they are. But they're not. Whereas liberal marches, liberal movements tend to look like America.
Yeah.
They have lots of white guys and white women in them, lots of middle class people. But there's also every other spectrum and shade, every other sexual preference, every other type, every other class represented. And that is what makes it so goddamn effective. So that when you have a nice old lady being pepper sprayed and falling into the arms of an Iraq war veteran, I mean, that's, you cannot create that. That's something that if I were to write it in a screenplay would be laughed out of someone's office.
Yep.
Speaking of which, a total aside, in case I get a little bit nostalgic, during the great paint epic of this week,
yes,
when I was cleaning out a bunch of closets, I did a little excavation and found a bunch of old rejection letters.
Oh, good
and
for you.
I found rejection letters from the Paris Review. I found rejection letters from Atlantic. I found rejection letters from Playboy. So I have been rejected by the best, Blue Gal, by the very best that are out. And this is all from, you know, 10, 15 and longer years ago. But that's my little history, and I don't know why I just went down this.
No, that's fine. That's fine. I'm proud of you for submitting your writing for actual publication, as opposed to, you know, just a blog post, Drift Glass.
Well, it does. It did remind me. I mean, my secret strategy for bringing this up was to make a clever story out of it, which was, look how much has changed.
Yeah.
You know, I still submit my work for publication on occasion, especially when I'm solicited by a famous writer who asked me to do it. And that got rejected too, which is also
that was
fine.
Hilarious too, actually, in its own way.
That was hilarious.
Yeah.
People will buy me a beer one day. I will tell them the hilarious story of how a famous writer solicited me to submit my story for publication, which was then subsequently rejected by that publication. But the pleasure of being a peer and talking shop with one of my favorite writers, literally out of a clear blue sky, was just priceless. However, the very media that I was trying to access, that I was trying to submit to 15 years ago or longer, is gone.
It's out of business.
I mean,
a lot of it.
A lot of them are out of business. A lot of the small presses are long, long gone. But the idea that there are these glass mountains of media, and at the top of them sit these seers and soothsayers who decide who lives and dies in the media world, that's dying. And it's dying because of people like, frankly, us. Mm-hmm. And because of blogging. And I'm not going to...
And I don't know the chicken and eggs part of that story. I don't know whether we're filling a void or whether we're actually kicking the bricks out from under that foundation. I think it's a little bit of both.
I think there would be no need for us. I think the entire blogging phenomenon and podcasting phenomenon, and frankly, Occupy Wall Street phenomenon, if you don't mind me, you know, grabbing someone else's coattails and hopping onto that bandwagon and mixing my metaphors freely because I'm tired and we're doing this live, baby, live, is because there was the marketplace had been roped off.
Yes.
If media had been fair about the Iraq war, if the media hadn't lied about the Bush administration, if the media hadn't been fucking complicit in such a way that people could see, you know, every day how surreal it was, how Orwellian it was, that what they were seeing on television bore no relationship to the real world.
Mm-hmm. There would be no blogosphere the way it is
today.
There'd
be no blogosphere. Yeah. If somebody had just told the fucking truth at the network level and consistently told the truth, then blogging would have been an interesting technical phenomenon that would have popped and gone, and podcast, and the technology would have kept
going. Well, we'd all be posting recipes, you know, or something else. Yeah, we'd be doing something else. But
the catastrophic failure of our media and our economic elite, our media elite, and our political elite to look after our best interests mm-hmm. was so devastating and manifested itself in so many really multi-generationally catastrophic ways. They destroyed the fucking economy. They have destroyed the middle class. They have wrecked our ability to talk to each other through the media. And we now need to fix that. Mm-hmm. And because they won't do it, because they are dead set against it, because their privilege and power would evaporate in a world where those problems didn't exist, we have to take power away from them. And that's where
we are.
Occupy comes in.
I think that's where our email from Dennis comes in, if you don't mind me just skipping over other notes in our notes pad here. But we got an email from Dennis, and really, this is live, people. We are really winging this week. Thank you for your patience with us as we do that. But we got a great email from a listener named Dennis. And actually, it went back and forth a couple of times, so I'll just read the stream of consciousness emails as they went back and forth. Dennis wrote to me and said, "I just wanted to comment that I do believe you guys didn't mention David Brooks once in this week's podcast. Must be some kind of milestone." And I wrote back and said, "I don't believe it." And he wrote back and said, "No trashing of David Gregory either. A sort of matrimonial mellowing." And he sent us a JPEG image of a tuna can with a label on it that says silence. It's a can of silence. And I showed you this and you said,
yes,
"I'll spread some silence on my toast tomorrow morning in penance."
Yes, I will. And
then I promised Dennis that we would make up for this. We would make it up to him. Mm-hmm. And so this week we're going to make it up to him.
We will.
You're going to take David Brooks, and I'm going to take David Gregory.
Yeah.
And go for it. Now, David Brooks was on Meet the Press last week, right?
Meet the Press.
He was on Meet the Press we combined the two of them, first of all.
We did.
And what David Brooks had some things to say about Occupy Wall Street that all of us thought were very amusing.
Oh, it wasn't about Occupy Wall Street.
Oh, no, that's right. It was about Penn State, right?
Penn State. Oh, it was David Brooks, you know, speaking of bat signals going up.
Yeah.
David Brooks, for me, is a convenient – because he's so consistently awful and so consistently powerful and sort of ubiquitous, you can't go a day without seeing David Brooks or hearing something he said or wrote out there as a reasonable position, as a centrist position. If he were just another idiot scrawling for a campus newspaper or writing, you know, digital graffiti someplace, I wouldn't give a shit what he had to say. He's just another rube out there doing silly shit. But his take on Penn State was so odious and so predictable and so just jaw-dropping. he just – his take on it was, as I said, speaking of the bat signal, he saw – I'm convinced what he saw was not a horrifying case of people in power abusing power, of child rape. What he saw was a hierarchy of elites, a hierarchy of powerful people who were being attacked because they were a powerful and corrupt hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And he cannot tolerate that. It is a reflex with him. If anybody out there ever goes after an elite group, a hierarchical group, as that is the problem, the hierarchy is the problem, he freaks out. He can't handle it. His universe is divided into elite, conservative, centrist, serious people who sit high atop a glass mountain and tell the rest of the world how to work, basically David Brooks, and a horde of dirty hippies who want to bring it all down. And that's all he understands. There's the traditional American value system, the traditional pyramid where he happens to be at the very top of it. And then there's just anarchy.
Yeah.
And there's nothing in between. So he, every problem he is confronted with, he has to, as I said in the pregame, there's argument, there's various logical fallacies. And one fallacy is an argument from authority. One of them is an argument from false causation. And I really believe there should be in there, just for David Brooks, an argument from ideological inconvenience, because his ideology cannot bear the idea that some powerful hierarchy somewhere is in fact the problem. So when this happened, he leaped into the fore and said, no. The real problem at Penn State was that 30 or 40 years ago, our morality essentially fell apart. We've been in this murky, anything goes, if it feels good, do it world ever since. And that's the problem.
Wow.
And he continued on by saying, you know, centuries ago, we had rules, we had moral rules, we had churches that dictated it, that told us how to live. And
the Catholic Church.
Yes, the Catholic Church. And to his credit, E.J. Dionne looked at him in kind of like, you know, this bug crawling up his leg, just kind of this look like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah.
The Catholic Church is the example of the most famous example of a corrupt hierarchy doing horrific things to children under the color of authority. And their whole stock in trade is religious rules. They're not a freewheeling, anything goes organization
at all. Yeah.
They've been around for millennia. And their problem isn't the dirty hippies.
Yeah.
And David Brooks just shrugged and basically ignored the question, which reminded me of the time last year, I believe, maybe the year before, when I actually went to a David Brooks presentation at the Hammerschmidt Chapel out in Elmhurst. And he was doing a lecture on Reinhold Niebuhr. And he was talking about how one must be modest and one must be careful in your opinion and humble and really not sort of judge and attack and just be very, very cautious about forming an opinion or really taking on any position because your position could be wrong. And this woman in the audience stood up during the question and answer period and said, well, okay, I appreciate you being here, but where in your Niebuhrian theology does your own history at the Weekly Standard fit?
Mm-hmm.
She said, because you wrote all these articles excoriating people who disagreed with you, calling them just terrible names and suggesting that they're bad Americans, that they're not, that they're just beneath you, that they're contemptible for having an opinion different than yours. How can you possibly, and considering the fact that you're the guy who got the Iraq War wrong, not them, how do you reconcile this with your Niebuhrian theology? And his answer was, I swear to God, I have it on film, was, I don't believe I said that. And then he just skipped right over it. His mind cannot bear the thought that he was ever wrong. So when he's directly confronted with the fact that his ideology is just bullshit, he just fucking lies about it.
Yes.
And he sat there on Meet the Press, blamed dirty hippie licentiousness for the Penn State problem, for the Penn State child rape situation.
Instead of blaming the institution and the money and the power and the sport,
the cult,
the zeitgeist that says we don't question what coach does.
No, because David Brooks is paid to protect institution and power and privilege and hierarchy. Yeah. That's his whole fucking raison d'etre. So the next day, in his New York Times column, he extended the metaphor. And he got very cagey about not mentioning the 30 to 40 year time span that he inferred was when this whole problem of the breakdown of traditional values began. But he separated the universe into the good old days when church told us what to do and the bad modern times when nobody knows how to react to a child being raped because, well, anything goes and who can say what and we don't have any good values anymore. And the thing that the cherry on top is the fact that David Brooks is a history major from the University of Chicago. Yeah. He knows what he's saying is not true. He knows that the church, specifically the Catholic Church, has a long and inglorious history of horrifying abuse, of anti-Semitic abuse.
And in case you think that is over,
yeah.
In case you think that that's been exposed and is over now, may I point out that Cardinal Bernard Law of Massachusetts is being hidden by the Vatican right now. Mm-hmm. He is responsible for shuffling rapist priests from one diocese to another administratively, mm-hmm. and covering up and protecting them and doing exactly what happened at Penn State, shuffling it under the rug and moving people around to protect them. And he was shuttled off to Rome before the cops came, seriously, mm-hmm. before he had to, you know, go before the grand jury. I think he'd been before a grand jury twice, and the third time they said, we better get you out of here.
This is right now.
He's 80 years old, and he's the dean of the basilica or something, cardinal of the basilica, something like that. He's got some job within Vatican City. And he's being, well, and he can't set foot on America. So they took him away and hid him.
Uh-huh.
So
uh-huh. The church,
right
the
now,
church,
right now, he's still there.
Well, the Puritans, David Brooks cited, burned witches, crushed people under stones.
Yeah.
And I wrote a long ass post about here are just a few of the massive crimes against humanity that organized hierarchical, powerful religion has committed in the name of protecting its own power and privilege.
Yeah,
and just as a final note, today's David Brooks column, I will just add, it wasn't bearing on this subject, but he decided to weigh in on economics, on what's going on in Europe. And this little sentence here caught my eye, that Americans in Oregon – this is why Americans are better than those stinky European liberal technocratic elites. Americans in Oregon are barely aware when their tax dollars go to Americans in Arizona. We are one people with one shared destiny. This is why we're so fucking awesome. Because one group of Americans doesn't really care or know where its tax dollars goes because we're all one people. To which I wrote, I'd like to know what powerful narcotics you were abusing when you asserted Americans are generally barely aware of where their tax dollars go based on we are one people with one shared destiny, given the fact that the single, consistent, defining characteristic of your conservative movement for the last 40 years has been an escalating, paranoid fury over the delusion that taxes are nothing but a dirty liberal scheme to confiscate hard-earned dollars from hardworking Americans and redistribute them to various groups of undeserving losers, moochers, and criminals. Mm-hmm. Oh, and by the way, the ideological forebears of your movement fought an entire fucking civil war because they didn't want to share the destiny with the rest of the country.
Yeah.
This from a historian. That's what makes it so fucking funny and tragic at the same time, is that David Brooks's columns, his New York Times columns and his Meet the Press columns, his Meet the Press appearances are riddled with these glaring, huge, obscene, ridiculous, comical errors that he creates out of whole cloth to justify his ideology.
Yeah.
And nobody ever challenges him on it, which I believe brings us to the subject of David Gregory.
It does. I want to add a Cardinal Law aside as well, because I mm-hmm. lived in Massachusetts when Bernard Law was elevated to cardinal and went over to the Vatican to become a cardinal. And he came back and landed at Logan Airport. I was living in Massachusetts at the time, and I would love for someone somewhere to find a video of this. He landed at a press conference, or at least he was surrounded by reporters at Logan Airport. And I swear to God, he made Marcus Bachmann look as straight as James Bond. Like he held up his hand with his thumb and forefinger on his ring and waved it side to side and said, "I got my ring, and mm-hmm. now I need to go see my mother." And I was watching the TV. That's a quote. That's what he said. Mm-hmm. I got my ring, and now I need to go see my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at the TV and I went, "Oh my God, he's such a fruit."
Uh-huh.
And what a flaming queen. You know, I just was thinking these terrible, today they would be considered slurs against gay people, and I don't mean it that way at all. But, you know, wow, well, he's just out there. And then I said, well, yeah, but he's a priest, whatever. But,
yeah.
You know, because I wasn't thinking that there would have it be any impact on other human beings outside of his own little circle. He could be sleeping with other priests and no one would, you know or care.
He's just a gay man.
The child rape part of it, you know.
Yeah, he's because gayness and pedophilia have nothing to do
with
each other.
Exactly, they don't.
But he was clearly a gay man in a position of enormous power at a church that is fanatically anti-gay.
Yep.
And in addition, it turns out he's a child molester.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if there's any charges that he molested children, but he sure did protect them. He protected child molesters over and over and over and over again. So,
and the church protected him.
Yeah. And still does to this day, David Brooks. They've got him hidden in the Vatican.
And the church has spent a considerable fraction of its massive global fortune paying off victims and
closing dioceses in Massachusetts that were under law over and over and over again under cardinal law. Yeah, yeah.
That happened.
That happened, and it's still happening. It's still there.
And it's not a result. Yeah. It's a result of a corrupt hierarchy of power that is unanswerable to anyone. Yeah. Essentially, the exact system that David Brooks would put in place if he could have a magic wand and make
it
happen. Absolutely. So, speaking of not challenging people who have great power, let's move on to Gregory, shall we?
I was disappointed in Lawrence O'Donnell last night because Thursday night he had David Gregory on talking about his, you know, show. It's called Pass with David Gregory. Like a press pass, I guess is what it's supposed to mean.
Yeah.
It's a web-only show, but it actually, to me, meant I'll take a pass about talking about my wife being a Fannie Mae vice president. Because
you've got a column up on this,
don't you? I've got a column up on this at videocafe.crooksandliars.com. Yeah. And it's just, you know, you would hope that Lawrence O'Donnell would have some interest in transparency.
Mm-hmm.
But David Gregory's sitting there talking about his interview with, what's his name? The lobbyist.
Jack Abramoff.
Thank you. He's have his interview with Jack Abramoff and how Jack Abramoff says, well, you know, Newt Gingrich is a crook. And he took money and he influenced Congress. And there's a system that allows this to happen. And it's wrong and it's corrupt and, you know,
it's legal.
Well, it's corrupt.
It's legalized corruption, but it's the most corrupt lobbyist in modern American history.
And you can see David Gregory during this interview crapping his pants and just say, corruption, that's a very serious charge. And the subtext of that is, you know, I'm going to have Newt Gingrich on my show either this Sunday or within the next week or so if I can.
My good friend Newt Gingrich,
who's always on his show. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to ask him what he said 6 months ago for sure. You know, so
because he never does.
Ever.
No, David, this is a little aside. I want you to continue on this, but David Gregory's show is the reentry point for Beltway villager insiders who fuck up and have to go in the penalty box for a month. And after they've been in the penalty box for a month or two for saying or doing something egregious and stupid, they come on Meet the Press. David Gregory doesn't ask them about it. They tout some new book or something, and they're back in the blessed circle once again. So that's the purpose of Meet the Press to a certain degree is the reintegration process of our little fallen angels of the media. So anyway.
So David Gregory is being interviewed about his interview. I mean, this is such a promo. And I have no problem with MSNBC promoing and cross-promoting their other shows and their other projects, but be upfront about it. You know, this is a promo spot, and so therefore Lawrence isn't going to ask any hard questions to the fellow employee. And what David Gregory said was, and I'm going to quote this, the background's important. The background is important. Uh-huh. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are quasi-public private agencies. They survived, and they made a great deal of money because they worked the Hill. But they went way beyond working the Hill. They had the Hill by the throat. This is Republicans. This is Democrats. Both sides of the aisle made a lot of money through these companies. So that's the backdrop. And not mentioning that his wife was vice president of Fannie Mae from 2006 to 2008 when it went into receivership to the taxpayer.
Fucking incredible. Fucking really.
Just
really.
And you know, Lawrence didn't bring it up. Lawrence didn't talk about it.
No. No.
And so here, I went and found this article, and it's linked at Crooks and Liars about, you know, David Gregory's wife is all over the pages of Washingtonian Magazine in 2007 talking about how she's planning to buy a pair of Jimmy Choos for spring, you know, and her fashion sense on at the workplace. And this is exactly at the exact same year that Newt Gingrich is collecting $30,000 a month from Freddie Mac. It's a culture. Uh-huh. It's a culture.
Oh, do you want to tell them what the article was just below David Gregory's wife's article about her $1,600 pair of shoes, whatever it was?
Are 20-somethings expecting too much?
Yeah.
And
it just, you know, if they would just not slap us in the face with how completely incestuous and how completely corrupt it is. And I think the larger text that I know you wanted to get at was, we like Lawrence. I like Lawrence
about
it.
This is in sorrow. I said that at the very beginning of my post. I'm saying this in sorrow, not in anger. Like, why? And why are you giving Newt Gingrich all this ammo to be able to now go on Hannity and say, well, David Gregory should talk. His wife made $3 million a year, you know, while I was making my millions. She had an annual salary. It wasn't a contract. She was on the payroll. Mm-hmm. I'm not accusing her of anything but being an attorney for Fannie Mae. I'm not saying she was corrupt. I don't have any insider information about her activities there. But she was one of the top four who had to resign when the taxpayers bailed them out.
Yep.
That she wasn't just a secretary. She wasn't just a, you know, person at a desk. She was general counsel to Fannie Mae. She was their attorney.
Meanwhile,
David Gregory doesn't mention that.
Doesn't bother to mention it at all. While doing a story about how the background on Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are really important
about how much money was going through Congress. Yeah.
And meanwhile, a couple of weeks ago on This Week with Christiane Amanpour, George Will, in what looked to be at attorney gunpoint, had to disclose the fact that his wife has just gone to work for the Perry campaign as a media consultant. Meanwhile, of course, Mrs. Alan Greenspan, Andrea Mitchell, continues to be a reporter there. Meanwhile, at the bottom of every Tom Friedman column in the New York Times and every appearance, it doesn't bother to mention that he's a billionaire and a massive real estate mogul because he married into a fortune. However, this loop closes in a certain way because a couple of weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, Tom Friedman was on the Lawrence O'Donnell show pimping his atrocious book. And we were all watching for Lawrence O'Donnell to sort of call Tom Friedman out on whatever his latest egregious bullshit was that everyone was just pulling their hair out that this guy can go on these shows and lie. But finally, he's on some show where the host is famous for not taking any shit. You know, who really does his homework and goes after him. And Lawrence O'Donnell gave him a complete pass.
And just to complete the circle, Christiane Amanpour's husband is an executive editor at Bloomberg News.
Yeah, which is owned by?
Michael Bloomberg. And he was in the State Department under Clinton. And, I mean, it just goes on. And it's not as if we aren't aware that Washington is full of power couples. But when there's a clear conflict of interest, somebody needs to say so. And as I said to you this morning, if they had taken one 30-second bit to say, hey, and you know, David, full disclosure, your wife was vice president of Fannie Mae in 2008. So we just want to get that out there. Mm-hmm. I would have had nothing to say. I would have had mm-hmm. nothing to say. But they cover each other's asses over and over and over again, and it's not right. And it's giving it's giving ammo to the enemy. It really is.
Well, and when we talk – I mean, at least on Fox News, the biases are right up front. Yeah. These people are – you can
they
see Rupert Murdoch's stamp on their fucking – they wear the sign of the beast on their fucking heads. You know, they're absolutely tools. But the left, you know, our media, our corporate-owned media constantly dings them for the fact that they lie and they cheat and they exaggerate and they don't talk about this incestuous relationship they have, this close tie they have, this with billionaires and media figures and so on. And you know what? This is what we mean, Blue Gallon, I mean, when we say our media is broken. Mm-hmm. We don't mean one newspaper or one TV station or one radio station. It is the ownership of the media in this country, insidious, incestuous relationship in Washington, money and media in this country.
And Wall Street.
Street is killing this democracy.
Yes, it is.
And it's killing it at the voting booth. It's killing it by the destruction of the middle class. And it's killing us by giving us only sugar, water, and poison to choose from when we go to select our media.
Well, don't forget Dancing with the Stars.
Yeah. So Tom DeLay.
Yeah.
And Dancing with the Stars.
There you go. There you go.
And they're laughing all the way to the bank, and we are laughing ourselves to death.
And if any of you have thought to yourself over the course of the past 102 episodes, wow, we really hope that Driftglass and Blue Gal someday have their own show on MSNBC.
Oh.
We just burned that bridge, baby.
Yeah. Well,
send us a contribution.
We love 80% of what Lawrence O'Donnell does. I know I do.
Absolutely.
We watch Rachel Maddow as often as – because that they really do –
No, Lawrence is my favorite. He reminds me of you. He's the angry Irishman. I love it. I love it.
The writer's soul.
Honest.
Yeah.
Most of the time he's just completely honest, but I think he does have these segments of the show where his job is to sell Chris Matthews' book or, you know, help David Gregory boost his web show. And, that, you know, if that's part of your job, I get that. But take 30 seconds to just say, you know, full disclosure, we need to just say throw this out here. Okay, now let's talk about it. And then you've shut me up forever. I can't say anything anymore about it because you did it.
And on our future show at MSNBC, we will be diligent about drawing a clear, bright line between what we're doing is promotional, and what we're doing is journalism or news or talking about.
Well, and all that fracking stock that you own, we'll mention that every day.
I know. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, we will. That's making me so rich.
We want to thank our listeners. You guys are great.
We do. We really, really do.
We have a Thanksgiving show coming up, and next week we will be reading your letters on the air. It's not too late to send us an email. Our email address is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Please write us. We would love to hear from you. What's on your mind? What you're thinking? Let us know. We have a Professional Left app at the iTunes store. If you have an iPhone, I don't think they've done the upgrade yet or the update yet for the iPad, but that's coming. But there is an app for the iPhone, which gives you links to both of our blogs, the podcast, and bonus content. So go look for that. Our podcast is on iTunes. It's also on Facebook. And we want to do a shout-out to our Crooks and Liars and Netroots Radio listeners. We're at Crooks and Liars at Open Thread on Saturday nights, Netroots Radio on Sunday nights. Also, of course, you can just go listen to us at our blog, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can listen to us for free with no download and no registration. At our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, there's an opportunity for you to pitch $5 in the hat to thank us. And nothing thanks us like an engraved portrait of Abraham Lincoln from the U.S. Mint. We would really love to have another one of those this week.
We'd love that.
You can use PayPal button, or we have a P.O. Box where you can mail a contribution to Professional Left Podcast, P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791. That address is at our website. Again, one last time, our email address. Write us, because we're looking forward to reading your letters on the air next week for our Thanksgiving show. Our email address is proleftpodcast@gmail.com. If you write us at that address or at our snail mail address, we reserve the right to read your email on the air unless you say otherwise, and we always only use first names on the air.
So let me ask you, Blue Guy, how the hell are those internet kitties doing this week?
The internet kitties are feeling great. By next week, they expect to be the Republican front runners.
Let's think about living. Let's think about loving. Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the bopping and the loving, lovey-doving. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
This podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license. Copyright 2011, Drip Glass Blue Gal Podcast.
And we're done.
I think that was a great show.
I think that was a great show. I think we should do it live from now on.
Maybe we should.
No.
The energy's good.
More importantly, I think we should do one that was really, really good. And it turns out I was running.
My microphone was humming.
Yeah. The vibrator fell off the bed and then it was whatever it was. It's those goddamn black helicopters
that
are overhead.
They're all the time. All over.
In our copious spare time, that's exactly what I would do, because one of the writing exercises that we used to do, we would read, we'd read selections. We'd sit in our little semicircle, and some of these I actually facilitated when I was a little bit older and had my own little writing groups. But, you'd read something one week that somebody had written, and you'd pass it around so that everybody else would read it aloud, so that it wasn't their dramatic stage voice that was making it sound good. It was the content. But next week or the week after, you would do a recall.
Yeah.
And you go around the room, what do you remember about so-and-so's piece? What do you remember about this? And only the most memorable stuff would invariably surface.
Yep.
It would be these
scenes. We did immediate recall in my writing class, but a week later would be really good, because then you'd have.
Then the connective tissue. Then the little strands between the scenes would hove back up to the surface, and it really did strengthen your ability to be very vivid and clear and immediate in what you're writing. Jump right in, start off with a bang, shoot the sheriff on the first fucking page, and run like hell towards the ending. That's not how you do a novel, or you get exhausted by page 20. But the idea that we would do an entire podcast, have it trashed, and then recall the most vivid pieces of it, and then redo it is kind of hilarious.
Yeah. Kind of worked. Cool. Yeah.
However, and in our copious spare time, we have our MSNBC gig. We will do that.
Interns, we need another latte.
Yeah. All right, babe. I'm gonna hang up.
I love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.